my primary philosophy on this whole thing is build the team and outsource as much as possible. Because if you're a busy professional, your time is much better spent at your job where you're making money, and let the investment grow on the side as much as possible, which you do need a team for.
Think your schedule is too busy to invest in real estate? Think again. We're thrilled to sit down with Tessa Muir. She is a very busy attorney and a real estate investor with 10 properties. We cover so much with Tessa that you're going to walk away with three things. Number one, you're going to learn how to align your investment strategy with your retirement goals. Number two, you're going to learn when not to negotiate. And number three, you're going to learn when it makes sense to outsource property management. Don't miss this episode. Welcome back to the Invest Her podcast. I'm Liz Faircloth and I'm running solo today. So I'm going to jump right into it with our guest, Tessa. Tessa, thank you so much for being on the show. We're going to get into how you bought 5 properties in 5 years, all while being a busy professional and an attorney nonetheless, with children and a full life. So we're going to get into that. There was something that was tragic that happened to you, though, right when you had your first child, your only child. Your husband passed away suddenly and unexpectedly. I'd love to just ask you, did that inspire jumping into investing? Or was that just the action that, something that happened in your life that really caused you to take action? Just curious to start there.
Yeah, absolutely was an impetus. So we had our first and only baby, and he, like you said, died very suddenly, unexpectedly, right afterwards. And so obviously it was a big life event for many reasons. And I've since remarried and have a wonderful husband and two wonderful stepchildren. Thank you.
Wonderful.
But yeah, that was really a life-changing moment in many ways, but really life-changing in the real estate realm specifically, because I had been researching for many years the field of real estate investing, the benefits of real estate investing. I was an avid Bigger Pockets listener for years. And I really needed a push to get off the sidelines. And that was certainly a push when all of a sudden I had all of the financial responsibility for our family on my shoulders. And it also allowed me to think, more independently, where I didn't have to bring a spouse on board in terms of agreeing with a strategy. And so I just took matters into my own hands and went for it.
Yeah. And it's very powerful, right? And I'll ask, there's women in our community that have been through a divorce. There's women in our community more and more that are just single, right? That have chosen not to marry. Then there's a lot of women who are in relationship that where they're pulling their spouse to the table, if you will, which is sometimes the other way around in other communities, but we're a women-focused community. But there's a moment that moves us from research, intrigue, interest to taking action. So what was that first action to take? I want to share with the women listening, we don't need tragic events to take action, but we do need to really create a space for ourselves to be inspired to take action, right? So what was that first action? What was that first thing that you did? You were doing research on BP. What was that first like real action you took to move the needle?
I can remember the moment that I moved into action very vividly, because I was sitting on the sofa in our living room and I was holding our baby and I looked out the window and I saw someone putting a for sale sign on the house across the street. And I had just downsized from one house to a smaller house just for me and our baby. So I was in a fairly modest neighborhood and it was a smaller house than mine going up for sale across the street. And I thought, well, if this isn't a sign that now is the time, I don't know what is. So I called my friend who's a realtor. We marched right over there that day or the next day. I was the first and only person to see the house and I put an offer in right away. Of course, I was immediately thinking like, oh my gosh, I'm moving into action. What have I bitten off? I'm a single mom. I'm an attorney. What am I doing? But I was already in it. And I knew in my mind from all the research that it was the right move. I just had to take the leap. And that was the leap that I took.
No matter what your belief is and you're listening to this, like signs are all around us to take action. We just sometimes see them and sometimes we don't see them. So a for sale sign came up. Was it a single family home?
It was a single family home. It was a modest little ranch, 2 bedrooms, 1 bath. It's like an apartment sized house. I knew that I could afford it. And I went for it. And I ended up learning a lot from that first deal, some of which I have replicated and some of which I have deliberately not done again.
Not done again. All right. So let's dive into the juicy facts. We learn a lot by just, I always say, you don't have to hit a home run on your first deal. You just got to get to first base. So let's dissect the first deal. So, you know, you called your realtor. It's a single family. It's a ranch. When you said you could afford it, walk me through what that looked like specifically, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So all of my properties, I did 5 in 5 years and now I've got 10 in 7 years. So all of the properties that I have, I bought very conventionally, just like you would buy your own home. So I did 20% down mortgages, personal mortgage loans, went with a traditional mortgage lender at a neighborhood lending agency. So I had the 20% down payment, and then I factored in about 5 to 10% more for repairs and improvements. And I have replicated the repairs and improvements that I did there in all of my properties. And I have kind of like a list of things that I always do. And with basically the goal of sprucing it up to the point where someone is going to want to live there for a while and feel like it's home. That's the goal. Without sprucing it up to the point where it's top of the line, you know, best house in the neighborhood.
Well, and that's a sweet spot. And that's not always something that when you're starting that you could figure out. So how did you initially kind of assess that? Did you go see other properties? People are funny, you know, that are investing in real estate. It's a product. you're assessing your product. The product is real estate. It's just like any product in business, right? I mean, it's a different product, but it's the same thinking. So how did you, you know, assess that in your first deal? And then how did you modify that? What did you feel like was enough? And when did you say this is maybe over improving?
I wanted to attract a person who wanted it to feel like home. So that's what I go for, because I think from a financial perspective, if you attract somebody who feels like it's home, they're going to stay longer, and then you avoid turnover and vacancy. So that's been my strategy. And so in that property and in all the other ones that I've done, I basically have outsourced the improvement of flooring, lighting, paint, and appliances. That's pretty much it. And for all of those, I've done them in different ways, whether it was hiring a handyman, some of it in the first one and only the first one I did myself.
Okay. And then you fired yourself.
And then I fired myself.
All right. Well, good. That's great. That's great.
And I did not rehire myself.
Good. Well, we have to, right? As we grow, we have to fire ourselves for certain things. So I want to go back to that. But okay, you outsourced the rest to a contractor.
It was a handyman, actually. It was somebody I pretty much cobbled together a group of handymen in that first deal, some of which who were great and some of which were not at all good at whatsoever. And then I found one that I liked that was kind of a quasi unlicensed contractor. And that was very helpful to have one person handling a lot of stuff, even though he wasn't necessarily like the best. For the major projects, like the flooring and the appliances, I just went to a big box retail store and I had them come out and measure and install.
So let's get into numbers. I'm curious. So you bought this property for what?
$124,000.
And it was a ranch. What was it, like 1,500 square feet, something in that ballpark?
I think it's about 1,000 square feet and then some basement space that's livable.
Kind of like a condo, but not a condo.
Exactly.
Size. Yeah.
Yep.
What year was this property, by the way?
1950s.
Okay. 1950s. Did it have newer like appliances or HVAC or anything like that? Or did you account for those kinds of repair capital, you know, expenditures?
In this particular house, it did have AC already was fine. I never had to replace that. The roof was fine. The windows were fine.
Those are three costly things. Roofs, HVAC, windows. I mean, if you need to replace all the electrical, that's a whole other ball of wax, right? Obviously. But typically those are three things that we, because we, you know, scaled our multifamily portfolio over the years, always something you want to look at, because those could be fairly decent, you know, large capital expenditure. Capital expenditure, think of as like your one-time cost. You're not going to do it every month. And then you have expenses that are monthly, right? Utilities, taxes, and things. Okay. All right. So you got about $20,000 you put down. How much did you assess to be the repairs? And then how much did you assess the property to be worth after the repairs and after it was fully kind of stabilized and optimized, if you will?
The repairs on that one were about $8,000 to $10,000.
Okay. Wow.
Which is pretty much what I anticipated. Afterwards, it wasn't worth substantially more than that. But since I bought it 7 years ago, it has more than doubled in value.
More than doubled in value. Tell me a little bit about the market.
I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I invest in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's the second biggest city in Michigan, but it's not a big city. It's like a big town. And there's very stable population here. There's lots of jobs. There's lots of different income levels. There's lots of students. There's a lot of people who are choosing between renting, but hopefully maybe buying in the future, who are kind of looking for like a home feel. And I think the best thing about all of my investments is they have almost all been kind of an uglier house on a safe, nice block. And so there wasn't like a ton of competition for any of these houses, but they are in areas with great comps. And then I can spruce them up with, you know, cleaning up the landscaping, the flooring, the minor things to sort of at least make them competitive with their peers in the neighborhood.
So many people, especially now, they might have a couple of rental properties in one market and now they're shifting to a different market. And then there's less certainty there because it's new, right? You have to, and then they find a property and they're like, I love this property. And then you ask them literally three questions about the market and they can't answer those questions. And that's a problem, right? You need to know your market. And in a lot of ways, you need to know it even more than the property. Not that you don't want to know about the property, but I always say market is over property any day of the week because you'll be able to move faster. When you bought, did you see the market kind of going up? Did you have that sense in terms of job growth or stability and those sort of like kind of metrics, if you will?
I did, yeah, because I was familiar with the area. And because I lived in that neighborhood, I knew that the kinds of long-term tenants I was trying to attract in terms of people who would treat it like home, they would feel at home in that neighborhood, which was important. And there was a very similar house just a couple doors down that was the first to break the 200,000 mark in the neighborhood. And they had done fairly minimal renovations and just nice staging. And I was like, ooh, this is a very good sign that a very similar comp that just had a third bedroom sold for over 200,000 in the same time period that I bought this one for 125. So I figured that was a good sign that that market was breaking 200,000 and that it was going to go up. And then I always check the Zillow history. I know people always say Zillow is not completely accurate, which is true, but the Zillow history at least shows you when it was bought, at what level, and what the potential market rate is. So I always look to see, is there an upward climb? Do the comps have an upward climb? And historically, real estate as an asset class does, unless you buy in a really defunct area.
How did you manage all this with your busy, busy schedule and a newborn and recently being single, right? Those are a lot of pieces of the puzzle that one of those is overwhelming to some people, right? And you had a lot there and you're like, you see this for sale sign go up and you're like, I'm buying it. Walk me through a little bit of the team because part-time or full-time, it's really hard to really be effective in this business if you don't have a team, even if it's just people to call on, regardless of employees or not, right? So the realtor was your first team member in a sense. What would you have done differently? Would you have done anything differently? Ask that realtor any different types of questions. Now you know what you know versus that first deal, because that is in a lot of ways a very key person for many people who are busy professionals, who are not necessarily going to like do all this research themselves. They just don't have the time. What could we tell the women listening that they can use as they're sourcing people to join their team?
Such a great question. Yeah. My primary philosophy on this whole thing is build the team and outsource as much as possible, because if you're a busy professional, your time is much better spent at your job where you're making money. And let the investment grow on the side as much as possible, which you do need a team for. So yeah, the realtor was my first one. She is a friend and I knew that she knew a lot about houses. So she was a really good person to walk through and she would say, you know, very technical things that we were seeing inside the house, in the basement. She would say, you know, I think you could eventually build a third bedroom here, but you would need to look, where's the gas line for the egress window? Like, she just had a lot of knowledge like that. And so I just knew that about her. And I've met a lot of realtors and I knew she is just a very quality person with a lot of knowledge. She referred me, that was my first team member. She's still with me. I do all my deals still with her. Second team member, same. I always do all my deals with him. He's a lender at a neighborhood lending institution, which I've learned through trial and error. For me personally, I don't have time to deal with big banks. I don't have time to deal with their bureaucracy and red tape and you get passed from department to department and one signature expires and you got to get it again. And then you have to do this and that. Going with a single lender who knows me personally, that I have his cell phone number, I would never have thought that that made such a big difference. And it does in terms of ease of getting across the finish line to actually owning the property.
So let me talk about that connection, right? Because it's like two things that matter, right? In many ways. There's actually three. Finding the property, you know, sourcing properties, finding the money so you can, you know, obviously there's a whole leverage point in real estate, which is great. A lot of creative financing. But at the end of the day, you know, having relationships with lenders isn't really critical unless you just have, you know, tons of cash on your pockets. But again, that's the beautiful part about real estate is that it's a leveraged asset if you're doing it the right way. Then it's managing. And we'll get to the managing part here in a second because that's where all the fun begins with landlording. I know because we self-managed up to 100 of our units.
Oh,
so
wow.
We did it for very, very long. So anyway, I want to just put a pin in what you said about the realtor and then I want to talk about the lender because this is really important intel, I think, for everyone listening. Even if you are an experienced real estate investor listening and you have some deals and you're looking for a new market, realtors should have knowledge in two things, right? They should have knowledge in like real estate, just real estate in and of itself. And they should have knowledge and know that market like the back of their hand. And the third thing, if they have, would also like just put them to the top is strong relationships with the people that you're going to need from an investing perspective, not just like, oh, I sell 100 homes a year. Never really talk to investors, don't really like them, but yeah, I can work with you. And then you hear that all the time. I'm like, no, that doesn't sit well with me. I want you to want to work with me. So then she sends you to the lender and you said something really important. And I think this is something that gets overlooked all the time. Community banks have so much more of an appetite for investment property that I, at least my experiences as well, than sometimes the big banks. I think that's shifting. You're seeing more and more, you know, certain banks kind of getting more aggressive, but in many ways it's the community bank. So what makes up a community bank? They have very few branches typically, and they're focused in a regional area versus anywhere. So if they're not nationwide, that tends to be that community bank. What was the criteria for your community bank that you've gotten a lot of, value working with? Do they just focus on Grand Rapids?
I believe they have other offices in other locations, but I just have one guy in the Grand Rapids office that, I mean, if I saw him on the street, he would ask about my family and my kids. Like, I know him now from this.
The part that I think is really important that folks could be doing now, because they said, oh, I'm analyzing deals, nothing's working out, I don't have the time. Start talking to lenders. Put it on your goals. Because you need to create those relationships before you have a deal. I mean, if I got like a hot project and I want to, you know, make an offer and that's not when you call lenders. It's like you're the last person at that party. So one of the most important people you can call and start, you know, developing relationships with is those lenders before you have a deal. Because what that's going to do, and I'm sure you saw this, Tessa, was that every bank is different, especially interest rates are, you know, supposedly coming down more and more. They're still, you know, higher than some of us would like, of course. And so some banks are not lending and being as aggressive with real estate. Maybe they're lending in other areas. Maybe they're like, no, this is the when to double down in real estate. Every bank is different. You got to know who's really lending and aggressively. They're the ones you want to work with because they're going to be more flexible with terms. You can negotiate all those sort of things. So have you negotiated? You're working with the same lender. What have you negotiated as time has passed on? Now, has this bank lended on all 10 deals?
Almost. Okay. Yeah, I have a couple with a partner that went with a different bank, but.
Okay. Have you negotiated anything with this bank since you have this kind of existing relationship? And now you know that, would you have negotiated that sooner?
That's such a great question. And I think that my answer is very reflective of my investing strategy. No, I have not negotiated anything with him because my philosophy is sort of as a busy professional woman, how can I invest as quickly and effortlessly on the side without getting super bogged down in like technical, highly creative methods? And I love to listen to those episodes that you all have and that Bigger Pockets have about these very creative financing deals. And I know they work, but I just knew they wouldn't work for the amount of time and energy that I was able to dedicate with a full-time job that's already very stressful. So the relationship with the lender, and he would say the same thing because we talk all the time, but I don't even rate shop anymore. And he knows that. And I know that he is not always the lowest rate. He would say that as well. But what we both agree on is that no matter where I get the loan from, they're going to sell it to somebody eventually, probably. So I want to get the easiest purchasing experience possible. Even if I'm a half point over another rate, I'm going to refinance in the next 5, 6, 7 years anyway, and I'm going to get a significantly different rate one way or another. So to me, I don't really care what the rate is as long as the rent is going to be more than that, plus taxes and insurance.
Yeah. That's really good perspective, right? Because we could, as investors, zone in on details that in the long run may or may not matter as much. Now, I'm not saying negotiating is a bad idea. I'm not saying that at all. I do, though, hear what you're saying. And I think as that busy professional, as that person who has a very limited amount of time, and we all should be that. We should all, meaning like, you know, it's almost like investing out of state. You should treat your local properties as though you're investing out of state.
Exactly.
Because it's setting you up for that. So I think that's a very interesting perspective. And when you bought the properties and now that you have 10, is your thought process like, okay, I want to own these for X years and then refinance and pull that out, do more of the same neighborhood, get into a new neighborhood? Like, what is your long-term vision, especially as someone who's looking to buy one or two properties a year, right? It's not your full-time gig. It's not something you want to get to 1,000 units. So what is your thought process like? How important is it to know your North Star so you can continually assess, right, and shift the gear to get you there?
Yeah. I think in the next few years, I will be at a tipping point because I will be reaching that 10 personal mortgages kind of cutoff point where you have to really switch into a commercial lending package. But for right now, my North Star that I see is buy and hold, because to me, 98% of the work and time and energy for me as an investor is in acquiring the property and fixing it at the outset. And then once somebody's in there, it's just almost on autopilot, other than the landlording, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But from an investing perspective, all that churning and burning and work really comes when I'm finding the deal, making an offer, and getting the mortgage and making the repairs. So at this point, I'm happy with letting those properties continue to appreciate, which they've all been doing, and watching a tenant pay down the mortgage debt for me. And I keep a spreadsheet of all the properties of what is their value now, what is their fair market value, and how much is left on the mortgage. And I just see that gap continuing to grow. And now it's like pretty substantial amount that is just kind of rolling on the side.
Your equity, right? Your equity is totally like increasing. I'm curious, when you started and now you have long-term tenants, is that the customer that you're focused on, and your numbers are still working out, making sense?
They are. I will say all of my wealth generation through the real estate that I have has been through this building of equity. So I don't take any cash flow, any money that I have that's left over. I just put it into an account to save for repairs or vacancies. Because I have a full-time job, I'm not needing to pull out, you know, money out of the investing. So that's why I run my numbers as long as what I'm bringing in is more than what I'm putting out, the numbers work for me.
Got it. So any cash flow, are they cash flowing? Say you did want to pull money out and live on it, not the, you know, the cash flow at least. Is that something that you eventually want to do and transition to?
Yeah. So if I were to cash flow off of my current investing strategy, I would need to scale substantially. I'm cash flowing like a few hundred bucks a month, which generally I put back into the mortgage to pay down the principal. So I'm not even seeing it. The strategy, which is really exciting that I have just put together with my husband, is in 10 years, we're going to sell off 3 or 4 of the properties, pay off our home, and be in a far better place for retirement. I'm expecting that they will all be worth $300,000 to $400,000 each by that point, and then hold on to the other ones for continued equity growth I may be interested in doing some kind of 1031 exchange where I, you know, bundle a few into another different kind of investment. But in terms of accelerating our retirement goals, I view these properties very similar to how I view my Roth and 401k, like they're investments that are sitting there for later for me to tap into.
Gotcha. So the selling off of three or four, depending on how much equity you can pull, would that be 1031, or you would use that cash, that excess cash, or the money that you've made in a sense, and deploy it into something else that's income producing, or another investment, or you're saying you take that cash and that would be maybe live on money, or you would put it into an asset? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, we're looking at building a house in the next year that's going to be, it's just with the market, it's going to be a lot more expensive than our current house. And so we're kind of thinking through the mechanics of like how long it's going to take to pay this off. And I think 10 years from now, it obviously a lot could change. But one idea that I'm having right now is to use those three or four properties, which will be almost, if not completely, paid off by the tenants by that point. And, you know, pay the taxes, dump the remaining money into this house, and I'll still have more assets and additional ability to get new ones.
I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And I think everyone listening, you know, a key takeaway here, a key action, right? Because we always talk about moving the needle. Because, you know, there's always a strategy to meet the goal you're headed towards. But so many people ask the first question, should I buy a short-term rental right now? Is this a good time to invest? That's like asking the wrong question. It's asking the wrong question. First, it's the first wrong question, meaning it's a question. It's just not the first one. So I always like to say that's like the fourth question. That comes after you've right. done the work like you and your husband have done, Tessa, to say, okay, what does retirement look like? What do we have right now? What do we want? And we want to build this house. Okay, so how do our investments support us with that? How do we keep making cash flow and growing our equity to get us to there? And if it's all, there's like, I just think that's great. And I want to just really lean into that for everyone listening, because it's something people don't do. It's the work that actually needs to be done. Yet everyone wants to talk about what property they should buy. Is this a good market? And all the other tactical, quite honestly, the easy questions. Those are the easy questions. We can go on and on about good markets, good strategy. But I do want to ask about landlording, because I think that is a enormous, the time that comes in with investing in real estate is always on the back end. It's after you sign the papers. So walk me through that a little bit. Do you self-manage, I would assume, all the 10 right now?
I did until I had four. So the first four, and so I have two different, well, I have kind of a beginning, middle, and currently where I am strategy for how I've managed. The first three, I did the same way. So I got the first three all in rapid succession. Once I got one, I was hooked. And I managed them all very similarly. So I was listing the properties on Zillow. I was meeting people to show them. I was collecting the rent. I was the face. They had my phone number. They knew my name. That was how I was doing it. And then the way that I was managing the repairs was through a really great home warranty, which required me to only issue spot when I got a problem. Is it a plumbing issue? Is it an HVAC issue? Is it a appliance issue? You know, and I had like very broad coverage. That gave me some certainty that I could get somebody out there quickly for a pretty finite amount of money. And they weren't expensive. They were very manageable amount of money and paid off in spades. Including when the entire AC went out in one house, they replaced the whole thing and that was covered. So,
like a home warranty, you're saying?
It's a home warranty. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So that was what I did for the first three. Then when I got to three, I was like, this is annoying. It was annoying trying to do my full time job and
it's a
having
great
all
way to say it. No,
communication
no.
with people.
Hold on. I gotta like deal with people.
Yeah,
I do that in my day. You're an attorney, yeah. right? I'm sure yeah. you have to deal with a lot of annoying people.
So it was annoying. So yeah, yeah. At that point, my parents moved here and are retired. My dad's super handy, so he was my first. He's not an employee, but he was my first like go to guy that I could really trust. Other than the contractors I had found on Craigslist and stuff. So at that point, my dad took over all of the turnover stuff. So when somebody would move out, he would then be the point of contact, or he would organize the dumpster. He would organize repairing the fence, repairing the this, that, the other. He would organize the painters or he would do it himself. He was so tremendously helpful. But he wasn't the point of contact for the renters themselves. So I was still getting the text messages and the phone calls. So that went on for a little bit. And then after I got four, I was like, this is now a business. Well, I always treated it as a business. It always was an LLC and stuff. But I was like, this is really feeling like a business. I have to really outsource this management part. So then I found a property management company that's local, that manages a lot of properties and has been life-changing. Oh my gosh, they're so great. They handle everything. And now the tenants don't know my name. I only know their name because I see it on the lease. I don't interact with them. The property manager covers everything and he's very, very communicative with me.
What has been the biggest thing you've learned in finding the right property manager? Because not everyone has the same experiences with property management companies. So what about them, if you had to go find another property management company in another area, would you look for?
The one thing that I love the most about them is when I was looking at different options was on their website, they had a lot of videos of walking through the properties that were available that they had for rent. And they were narrating, we've just put in this new countertop. We've just replaced all the door handles. Here's the new sink. And they were very similar to the amount of repairs that I would do myself. It was like, here's a new laminate countertop. Here's a nice new carpet. It wasn't fancy stuff, but it looked good. It looked fresh. They were nicely done. And they were in the same rental income bracket as the properties that I had. So I felt like they had a lot of knowledge in this comparable field. And then, I would fire any property manager in a heartbeat that didn't communicate well with me. And they've been very, very good communicators. But I need to know if somebody's not paying their rent. It's not enough for me just to not get an owner's draw. Like I need to know they're not paying rent. I need to know you've sent an eviction notice. I need to know that their cat destroyed the hardwood floors. Like I need you to tell me because I need to know that the renters are being taken care of because if the renters are being taken care of, then my property is safe. But if the renters are not being taken care of, then my property equity and the value of it is in jeopardy.
I love what you're saying. I just want to highlight two things. The fact that they have a website, because some property management companies don't, and they are showing walkthroughs on their website tells me they're also tech savvy enough to innovate and stay with the times or even go one step further, which is a really, really important sign with property management. So I just want to put a note of that. And I want to also mention one of our partners, Inago, has a free property management software that we see a lot of women in our community using, whether they're self-managing or, you know, they've outsourced. I'll put the, for everyone listening, it's INNAGO.com. They're on our website and there's like a link on our website to go straight through our site. But people have just been raving because it's maintenance to everything under the sun and it's free. It's actually a free software. It's very robust for free. Yeah. Make sure we get that added to the show notes. But this has been great. I think there's always a way to invest, whether it's you have no time, you have a little time, or unfortunately, maybe you lost your job and you have all the time, right? But I do think when you have little time, you get very smart about how you're spending your time. And I think I love your approach. And it doesn't have to be a million properties. It could be very, you know, steady and smart. And it has to align to your North Star, which is your 10-year goal. That's a huge recipe for success. So love what you're up to, Tessa. Thank you so much for being on and sharing your wisdom with the women and men on our show. Where can everyone learn more about you and connect with you further?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook and Instagram. My business name is called investontheside.com. So I'm Invest on the Side on Instagram and on Facebook. But the best place to really connect with me is probably through my website, which is investontheside.com/how-to-start.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on again. And everyone listening, do something with what you learned. Take one action and move that needle towards your financial goals and your financial freedom goals. And that's what we're here for. So thanks again, Tessa.
Thanks, Liz.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to receive updates on our next interviews, go to our website, therealestateinvestor.com. There, you can subscribe to our show, become part of our investor community, and get updates on upcoming episodes.
If you like our show, please share it with other women who would benefit. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. And as always, we encourage you to take one action as a result of today's show and put it into motion so you can live both a financially free and balanced life. Thanks for spending time with us.
Ciao.